It's time for the Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Dale, here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we are here to discuss the second episode of the second season of USA's Colony, this one called Somewhere Out There.
Aw, American Tale.
I also thought American Tale the first time I saw it, but then after really thinking of the way the cold opening to the show works, It seemed like it also spoke to that.
For sure. I think we're going to find that it works on multiple levels.
Speaking of the cold open, did that little scene, I don't know, what did it mean to you?
I thought it was great that we got a time frame here that there's been a whole lot more contact with some other species than what we thought. This is not just like, oh, for the last year, this has been going on. So the opening said it was 1969, and this appeared to be a NASA group, or at least a NASA recording. And then I'm not sure, did they ever identify who the people in the room actually were?
No, they did not. And there was a variety of people, different ages. Well, they were all men, but the guy in charge seemed to have an accent that I couldn't quite place. It sounded a little German to me, which would make sense because a lot of our rocket scientists were German at the time, but I couldn't quite swear to it that he had a German accent.
It was interesting in the recording. They let us know that these were actually astronauts who were on the dark side of the moon and that they could hear something. They were referring to it as music. And when I heard the sound that they had isolated, it sounded to me kind of like an ultrasound, like in a womb. Like there was sort of like a faint heartbeat kind of underneath it. And then there was kind of all this kind of whooshy, kind of underwatery kind of sounds. Very ultrasoundish.
It sounded to me like, I don't know, cycling machinery or something.
Okay.
Large machinery, not like a gas-driven motor, more like an electric generator or something like that.
Intrigue. Okay, so they referred to the spot that the sound was coming from as like a beacon?
That's an interesting word because we thought we knew what it meant, but we looked it up just to double check. I thought it meant something like a lighthouse, which was something that would draw your attention to it and pass along some kind of warning. And in fact, beacons throughout time, the term is applied to all different kinds of things. And it's not just a matter of drawing your attention. It is also a matter of communicating something specific back to you. In the case of a lighthouse, it's don't come over here. But it could also mean come over here or, you know, just something more specific. Like, what were you looking up that used different flags as part of the communication scheme for this beacon? It was like ship to ship or something like that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of communication like that. Specifically, the ones that I was looking at were like the huts that were sort of on like mountaintop type of situations where they would blow smoke. And so that like a village, like say like three hills away, you would light like the first hut the furthest away if you saw invaders coming. And then when the second hill saw the smoke, they lit their smoke and then the smoke for the next one. And those are also called beacons. And so what I thought was interesting was thinking about it in terms of a warning or of an impending attack. That felt very like, oh, that feels kind of right on. Like, who knows what information they were sending in 1969. And you and I talked a lot about the idea of like leaflets and the idea of sending information or communication to citizens of an area that you plan to attack, or at least that you want to manipulate in some way, which I found pretty fascinating, the idea that the leaflets didn't necessarily need to be factual. I always thought that they were sort of sent out like, we're going to bomb here on Tuesday. So if you don't want to die, everybody go somewhere else. That's what I honestly thought leaflets were like. But it was also more like if you wanted to just manipulate your enemy. So for instance, in previous wars, like the Germans sent out ones that were nostalgic for Americans, like, oh, do you remember your loved ones? Don't you miss them? That type of stuff to encourage them to give up and surrender. So there was like all kinds of ways to handle it that for the Americans, we sent over to the Germans, our leaflets were just pictures of fields of German graves. And we were like, back at you.
Right.
So basically, there is a lot of ways.
You don't want to start a leaflet war with us. We will kick your ass.
We go right to that point that you don't want to go, right? We go right over the line. So the idea that it could be some sort of warning, and that it may not have even been a direct warning, like, we're coming to get you, but it could be something that was enough that just manipulated our behavior in some way, maybe unknowingly, that created something in our world.
Or it could have been, they thought they were sending a message and we had no way to read it. sort of like we also looked up the Voyager satellite programs, the deep space, or at least solar system exploration craft that we sent out in the 70s that also included what they called the Golden Record, which was a phonograph of a sampler of life on Earth, that if you were an alien, you could crack this thing open, pull out the golden record and see what we're like.
I feel like, and immediately stare at it and be like, how am I supposed to play this thing, right? Because I don't know how we would play.
I haven't had one of those in years, right?
Exactly. And it was interesting, the stuff that was on it, because it was all types of music, but it was also just sounds. So there was like a presidential speech, there was a baby crying, there was just sounds of all the diversity of Earth. I think the idea, though, that potentially in our fictitious story here, that we may have been hearing something for the first time in 69, and then let's say in real life in 77 is when we sent up Voyager. I kind of like that timeline, like maybe we heard something first and we're calling it quote unquote music. So our natural response was to send a record back, right, into space and think, oh, well, we must need to send some sounds back to them.
Right.
I like that as like feeling like a very natural flow, using maybe a fictitious part here with our story, but then a very real thing that America did.
That's an insight I hadn't even thought of, just that Voyager was not a question, it was a response.
Maybe it was. And I had always thought it was, I know they refer to it as a probe, and so I always kind of thought maybe it was more just exploratory, like I thought. But if this potentially, there was a catalyst in 69 where we actually heard some sounds, and so we were trying to respond, wow, what a fascinating concept. And who knows, maybe our music or maybe something that we put out there made them angry. Or maybe it right. simply took that long to get here. You know, I always feel like there's a little bit of a thought that space is so wide open that in a way, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to reach out, which seems always like a good thing, you know. But like the scene that we had with Katie and the gang when they found the host, and there was that moment of like, is the suit here to protect us or protect him? Mm-hmm. And it always kind of makes me feel a little bit like, is the distance we have between other civilizations to protect us or protect them, or what? Like, could it actually mean something that there is such a huge distance between civilizations? Maybe if you think about, you know, the universe being around for so long, maybe civilizations that lived within a certain radius of one another just obliterated one another. So ultimately, we only can survive if civilizations are X amount of distance apart.
And that's a pretty cool theory.
Then that makes me wonder, like, do we want to be found? You know, like, I know we want to reach out, but every time humans seem to reach out and cross each other's boundary lines, whether it be countries or whatever, there stands to be some scuffle of who's going to be in charge.
Right. There's not a lot of agreement.
How's it going to work? Away. So it kind of seems like, I wonder if potentially if in the 70s, let's pretend Voyager reached out to somebody and we simply made ourselves known. Was that like a, like maybe we shouldn't have ought to have turned the light on, in the house, like maybe we ought to should have laid low. I don't know, but I very much appreciate this idea of distance may just, we kind of look at it as the negative of like, oh, we're so far away from anything else. Things are so far away, but maybe that's what keeps Earth alive and thriving.
These guys reminded me of a subplot from the X-Files. Aliens were going to invade Earth. It was just a fact. And there was a small group of men who knew about it, who had cut some sort of deal with the aliens that in order for the aliens to invade, they needed to do something like create a hybrid alien human or something like that. And the humans said, okay, hold on, we'll just take care of that project. And when we're done, then you can invade. So the idea is that there were people that knew of an invasion ahead of time and kept it quiet.
So you're saying they almost kind of prepared for the aliens? Because, and I don't mean like prepared in terms of defensiveness. I mean like kind of prepared.
That was the double cross. They were planning on double crossing the aliens.
Well, we're always going to double cross the aliens, of course, clearly.
Of course.
But I mean, but they were presenting it like they were preparing it to...
For invasion, yeah.
For invasion.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes sense to a lot of the things we're talking about.
Because there's some collusion here. We don't know if these men in that room lead to
the
men in black coming in recruiting people the day before the invasion.
I know it has to. And especially, I mean, it would be more like the steps before that would have been like, who dug those holes in those tunnels and put up the lighting in there? And who made, you know,
right.
Like men here on Earth did something to prepare for the aliens to come, because the planet was, like you said, kind of prepared for their arrival, in that all of that infrastructure of the colluding humans were in place for the host. When, mm-hmm. Once the walls went down, there was already a hierarchy. There was already a system. People already knew where to go and what to do of those who were going along with the hosts.
Right.
Because this was just simply a transition, right?
Yeah.
This wasn't an invasion. They never called it an invasion. They never called it a takeover or anything negative. They called it a transition, which is a pretty loaded word for me, because it just seems like one of those things where it's like, I guess that's what you could call like transitioning to me being dead. I guess that's true. But it's like, I kind of don't want to just view it like that, because transition seems very benign. But what a smart and manipulative word to use with humans. It's just a transition.
Right.
And plus you can say crap like growing pains. And you know, we can't have change without some uncomfortableness, you know, and people, we kind of have that as humans mashed in our faces all the time. Like no pain, no gain. That kind of like attitude that's like, we're just transitioning right now. We might kill one or two of your children. It's a transitionary period from a 5-family household to a 3. Cool it. We're just transitioning, you know, like interesting way to bring it up.
One person who has had ups and downs with the transition is Jennifer.
Yeah. And we had talked a ton about surveillance in our last episode and about how we knew we would be seeing a ton more surveillance in coming episodes.
Did you expect that it would be Jennifer sitting behind?
I really didn't.
The
when
monitors?
They showed us all the monitors on the wall and then Jennifer kind of pushes back from her chair, I was like, wow. So do you think, did Jen get that job post Will and Beau's disappearance, or has that been her job since day one? Is she the screen monitor always?
No. That wasn't her job, because that seems too low level for her. But the hierarchy of her team was decimated recently, mm-hmm. and she was the last man standing. So they needed something for her to do, is my guess. Maybe she volunteered. I'm not sure exactly how she got back there. Maybe she loves doing it. I'm not sure.
Do you remember that point in time when Will and Beau, there was a dramatic shift to where it seemed like Jennifer had roles that were very equal to them in terms of the investigations and actually going out and mm-hmm. doing different assignments.
And she became the man back at the base calling things in and
working
the computer.
Or not even like getting them coffee. I mean, there was legitimately times when she was just like making snacks and stuff. And everybody said, even on screen and off, like, what happened? Why did Jennifer get like sidelined? I wonder if it was about that time that she may have moved over to some amount of the surveillance camera stuff, just because it seems like she just dropped off. So in a way, I kind of want to make up a job for Jen and say like, okay, that's probably where you went during those times when we didn't see you, because it seemed like you didn't have an assignment. So it's possible it's like, we only need 2 people to do this, and Beau and Jen were doing it. Now Will and Beau are doing it, so Jen, why don't you fill in over here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of seems like a natural time.
Well, Will made the right call, I think, because I feel like she's going to be kind of slippery with her alliances. She feels like she's on the winning team, and she's actually working at a point kind of above her previous station as dating website database guru. And so she wants to keep winning, basically. So does that mean trying to land something big by leaning on Katie a little later?
So far, Jennifer has shown us really only one side. I mean, I really don't think she is kind of what you say, you're like, you're saying slippery. I'm saying, like, I don't think she's bent on her allegiance. I think that she said, I voluntarily joined, they call it the task force, something like that. She voluntarily joined and she has been actively pursuing all the investigations. She never seemed to be angling for something where she benefited. In fact, like I said, like, it seemed like she actually kind of got demoted a little bit. And even though she kind of a little questioned it, she still was pretty competent in everything that she was doing. I don't get the vibe from her yet that there is this other sense of like she's going to do something to trick Katie or anything. I think it's all going to be above board. I think she's going to say, where we are, you are in the submissive position. I have more power and you need to help me move along in this investigation. And so almost sort of more in the vein of getting someone to turn on an investigation, right? So it's not so much that you befriend them because you're being slippery, you befriend them in some way because you need their cooperation to get the information to move on. So you get what I mean? Like, I don't think she's in any way tricking Katie. I think everyone knows we are working for the hosts.
They kept showing her, like you mentioned last season, where she kind of came up short with what she felt like she deserved. And then already in this season with that meeting with the new boss.
Oh, man. What'd you think of old Dan Bennett? He was intimidating guy.
He would be a very unpleasant person to work for and be around.
I feel like it's the type of thing that when he comes in and he shuts the door, everyone does that thing where they like hunch their shoulders, like, oh, like they jump at.
Like if school principals had a boss, that's the kind of guy this guy is.
School principals do have a boss, Paul. So he's like the superintendent, if you will.
Right. He's like the superintendent. No, I just mean like someone that he's more rule follower than the rule followers. You know, he's.
I think that he is the kind of guy too who feels very much like you do not get second chances. This is my vibe of where we are in the story, where there has been enough shenanigans, there's been enough like sort of rioting or looting or doing different little things around that have pissed off the hosts,
the higher ups,
the actual host, you know, being taken and all that stuff. That was all insane. And I honestly think they've had enough. I want to talk about that a little bit more with Bram and Katie. So Ken from Chicago and I have been having like a lengthy conversation about that idea about whether Katie was justified in touching Bram's hand when they were in the prison. My feel of the climate right now with how there's such a more serious lockdown feel, I feel like Katie reaching her hand out to Bram was a selfish move on her part to comfort herself and want to have some way to comfort him. Like, I get it, but that was fulfilling her need. He didn't reach out to her. I feel like this is such a strange climate that breaking even a small rule at this point really feels unbearably reckless.
On your first visit,
just,
right?
Like, and just so
it's a sort of rule that the same, if the same guard has been helping you for like 5-10 times doing this same little task, 2 minutes, you get to visit with your son, then he's taken away. And then he happens to see you touch fingertips on number 10. He's not going to kill you. Most likely.
Right.
But on visit one, you don't have any rapport with this faceless guy in the red hat.
The idea of there being more surveillance, I feel like even our characters, I think, are more aware of surveillance. I think. Now, do you feel like they're starting to vibe that I think I'm being watched more often and more often, at least in that lockup room? Would you not think beyond just the guard outside? Wouldn't you think they had cameras and stuff in the room?
Obviously. I mean, we don't even have alien overlords yet, and that would be a logical assumption even in the smallest police station in the country.
So my whole kind of situation on any of Katie's moves right now comes down to the idea that the environment has changed since when we first met her. There was still a lot of loosey-goosey activities going on that, whether or not I agree with what she was doing, for the most part, they kind of knew the avenues that they could and couldn't go through. Like, she had her insulin hookup and she had these different things and she knew the code names, and she was still very much playing by the rules, though.
Well,
the rules of this other society that she was a part of. Okay.
Yeah,
but she was still following those rules. And now I feel like even when the rules are very clear and now her children are in extreme danger. I mean, extreme. We are not outside in our backyard under the orange tree. We are in lockup with a man with a machine gun right outside the door. I don't understand why her behavior wouldn't change in the least. Where her words can be comforting and she could say, and maybe even he goes to reach out and she says, Bram, I love you so much and I would love to touch your hand, but I have to say, like, at this moment in time, the best way for me to comfort and protect you is to keep you legitimately safe. And the way to do that is not to break any rules in here. That's how I feel about it. Now, I know any listeners might say, no, I would reach out and grab and hug my son. Well, I hope you're prepared then for the guard to come in and beat your child in front of you and maybe kill you both. Then go find Gracie and kill her. I hope you understand that there would be consequences.
But at least
that.
You got to touch fingertips.
I think it's a understandably no-win situation. You want to comfort your kid, but at the same time, this just isn't the climate to be breaking these small rules for zero gain. You know, you just can't do it.
Well, Katie has made one change. She's not actively resisting the government and with a cell anymore because there's no one left, I guess. There's no one to tell her what to do. So she is not doing that anymore. At least that's what she tells Jennifer when Jennifer comes and talks to her.
Which I guess I want to say, okay, you know, and I mean,
right.
it's not like we saw the growth of a character though. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, that's just like saying,
right.
Well,
everyone around her was killed and she said, oh, well, I'm not doing that anymore.
Well, and I don't know that she even said, I'm not going to do that anymore. I feel like it was like, there's no one to do it with anymore. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, so I don't feel like she made like a conscientious change. We didn't see like this growth of a character where she said, you know, I don't know, in the Dr. Phil words, like, how's that working for you? I don't know that resisting in this way and trying to think that every single rule should be snubbed and I should try to kind of be like a snot about sort of everything. I don't know that that is going to benefit my children or my family at this point. Because frankly, here she's got Maddie who is kicking it over here, living by the rules, you know? Now, were they ethical, moral, awesome rules? No, I feel like she probably is not in love with Nolan. This is probably completely 100% taking advantage, using everybody, all that stuff. So I'm not saying that Maddie's like on the up and up in terms of ethical things, but I feel like she is a glowing example that, hey, Katie, there are other ways to handle things around here. And you've actually got some strong women around you, Katie. You have Jen who, you know, has now been given this mandate by Dan Bennett that she has got to find answers about where Bo and Will are and basically figure out what's going on. Were you a little surprised with that particular conversation when she was like, from what I understand, he got a transit pass and he's over in Santa Monica? Was that all on the up and up? Is that like, oh, okay, cool. He has a hall pass. He can be over there.
I think he's more like, even though he has the legal papers to go through the gates, I think he's more or less AWOL at this point.
Was Jen's mandate then from him that you need to locate and bring back Will and Bo?
If so, then I kind of like Jennifer a little bit more because when she went to talk to Katie, she only asked about Broussard, which would be a way of kind of implying, how about I bring you this really big fish rather than worrying about my old friends?
Definitely said, you know, he wants Broussard. I mean, Dan definitely said that. But I was just asking, like, even between the lines, when he asked about where Will and Bo were, was it implied that she's supposed to find them or give him more information about those two? It just seemed a little like he was like, are you sure you don't know more about them? And then he just went on to Broussard. So I didn't know if there was, like I said, an implied idea that she needed to somehow.
If she produced them, it wouldn't be bad for her. That's
would they
sure.
be, Bo, I assume, would be in trouble given everything. Would Will be for, I mean, he left on an honest transit pass and he was supposed to be going to his kid. And I assume the transit pass legal and everything. So would
the
he
latitude
be in trouble?
And position that Will had was all thanks to Snyder. And Snyder doesn't have that power anymore. So he doesn't have anyone in his corner saying, yeah, okay, you can bend a little bit here as long as you get a result. New people would have no idea about any of that.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out if Will legit followed the rules. There would be no reason for anyone to think he's like AWOL or yelling at him or bringing him back, like hauling him in kind of thing, because got a pass from the sitting proxy at the time. And that's where he is, just where he said he'd be.
It may just work more like a visa, letting you go in between countries than actually being like, you have permission to go whenever you want. And we'll just take care of your schedule until you get back.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the fact that he just like left work, you know,
right.
Like
that's
like
what I mean by AWOL
went away. Like, that's true.
He works for
it.
The government. you know, he's paramilitary, if you will, and he's only been there like a week last year.
So yeah, no, that's true.
He hadn't
true.
Had any vacation built up.
Well, and I definitely felt like Dan was all about sending a message to her with the whole like going to her house with Homeland Security and like having them like wreck her entire place. Ugh, that felt very like boot camp. We got to like break you down so that you like are part of this group kind of thing. I felt really sad about her picture frame being broken. And do you think we're going to get some backstory a la like Phyllis and Maddie about like, is that her husband? And
No. Remember, she had, it was either her husband or fiance, but
I want to say fiance. That sounds right.
But it didn't, you know, he's not around anymore. That scene and plus her reaction to Bennett and a little bit with Katie, how she kind of let her off the hook a little bit. I'm sure she's going to be back in Katie's life. But in that moment, she didn't pursue her. I wonder if there's a conflict brewing in Jennifer. And that's what I meant by slippery. I don't mean like she's kind of dishonest. I just mean like at some point, will her allegiance shift to her friends rather than the winning side?
We'll see. And I am going to shoot out just a concept that, yes, we got a little nugget in season one about her fiance, but I feel like the fact that we saw his picture again and she kind of had that moment where she was looking at it, there's something inside me that says, I wonder if we're going to get some sort of flashback and it's going to turn out that she made a choice then that where it was allegiance choice, which got her loved one killed or turned over to the powers that be, which makes me wonder, like, will this be a repeat for her where it's like, okay, now you're going to be put in a situation again. Maybe it's Will, I don't know who she's going to be in that relationship where it's like, okay, you have a choice again. Now this time is your allegiance going to stay with the powers that be again? Or did you feel guilty and awful enough about that guy being gone the first time, the fiance being gone, that you would make a different choice this time?
I hope they do. Because, I mean, I know they only get 10 episodes a season for some reason. And that means you don't get to have 70 deep characters. You get a handful. And then everybody else, you just kind of have a good feeling about. But Jennifer, they could have done anything with her in the off season. You know, just wrote her out of the show or something. But they brought her back. They gave her like this kind of heavy handed, you know, your friends ran away. And that makes us think that you might have had something to do with that kind of message. I sure hope that we get a little more, not just what she does this season, but why she is who she is, you know?
You know, we talked a lot about how guilt plays into how a lot of these people behave.
Yeah.
And that, you know, maybe the guilt of how she behaved somehow, I don't know what, with the fiance, maybe there will be something that she felt like she had to be like extra vigilant at her job to sort of justify the fact that her fiance got killed or taken away or something. Like, she had to throw herself that much more into the cause because the cause has to be that good in order that she lost him. And now as time is going on and on and on, and she's seeing like more and more things happen. And now people that she's, I think we thought she was kind of brewing a little romance with Will, right?
I thought she had some chemistry with Will, yes.
Right. So then in that case, like maybe she's starting to feel that feeling again. It's like, this is your second chance. This is your, you might have love again. You didn't think you ever would, but now maybe you're getting something here. Even let's say platonic, even let's even go that way and say you have a strong connection to another human being for the first time since the fiance sitch. Then are you going to play this out differently? And will this be more of a character growth story than this idea of, can you live with your choices? Which is where I was going with the Katie Bram stuff. Like, can you live with your choices? If you did something and your child got hurt, could you live with that? And then for her, if you get to redo it, how do you play that out differently? That's sort of where I'm going with Jen. And I like the idea that we kind of called it last week, that Katie and Jen were sort of the two kind of dangling ends, that with Broussard and the crew being gone and Will and Bo being gone, both women needed a group to group up with, because basically it's safety in numbers situation here. So you need somebody to be your ally. I feel like they're going to be not only just like unlikely allies, but sort of that begrudging allies. I think that Jennifer is going to have to somehow be more faithful to Katie than she'd like to be. And I think vice versa. I think they're both going to have to work together. And maybe that will set up a real interesting triangle when Will does come back on the scene with them, because it's sort of like if they both were working together, you can only be with one woman here, you know, like, and this family is pretty splintered. So I don't know how we get back together.
That reunion's charged. I mean, assuming Charlie makes the trip. you know, the mother of your long lost son.
And your current wife.
That's going to be a big moment. But then you also have this person that's been lying to you, and you have no idea the extent to how much she put you in danger or saved you from danger or anything. But you do know she had something to do with a lot of the danger you were in. And she was at the heart of causing the new breakdown in the LA block.
And making everything a whole lot worse. A whole lot worse.
And her short-sighted selfishness.
Well, what do you... Okay, so how are you... I've expressed clearly how I feel about Katie these days in that I just feel like I understand that she's a character who's written in a certain way. And I appreciated that Ken pointed out that you can have characters who are really technically, stereotypically unlikable. Like you can have a gangster, you can have a really bad person who they can have moments of redemption in the way that they're written that you still like them. You actually really like them.
She's not Tony Soprano to me.
Well, and why though? What is it about the way that Katie is written that makes us feel so frustrated with her versus why doesn't she come off like this unlikely hero coming up from the ashes kind of person? Like, why does she feel so negative?
I am doing what the writers programmed me to do, which is want Will to win the day. The way that she is basically undermining what he was trying to do last season means, why can't you just help him rather than hurt him?
Okay, so you just feel like because for you, Will has been set up as the hero and anything she's done, especially like lying to him, she's already the anti-hero.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
just hurting him. For me, it's not that she has a different agenda. I could deal with the fact that she has a different agenda. My issue is about how she goes about doing it. I think that you can be on the quote unquote like wrong team from the team I necessarily want to win, but I can still appreciate you making smart, clever, really insightful choices that would say, okay, you know, this is a 50-50 situation. And if you are thrust into this, which side of the coin do you fall on? I want those sides to be stronger. I want it to be where it's not easy to know, well, I would have definitely done what Will did because they wrote him that way. They made that seem more dignified or something, you know, to somehow go along with this and work within the system. I feel like there's some lack of feeling like there was any direction with her. She feels so much like she just flails around, and so much fallout comes from even small decisions that she makes. That feels aggravating to me. You know, you can have really great characters, really great. Okay, so I know you follow Game of Thrones, and I know that every character there is really written with their own point of view in such a way that you can kind of appreciate how they go about doing things, even if you're not on their side.
Yeah, when you brought that up, the first thing I thought was Tywin Lannister, the patriarch of the family, remember the grandfather to the king, and he is not a likable guy, really, but he is a villain that you really, really liked because there was just some sort of swagger to the guy that was just really appealing. But also his daughter, Cersei, how she ended last season was spectacular. It was like, oh my God, I can't believe she did that. But at the same time, it was a horrible act.
but it's partially because it was so smart and so complex so well thought out.
Because it built up and all season. You didn't see it coming.
Yeah. And that's amazing. And I feel like that's what we're missing here. Anybody who kind of asserts that it's like, well, it's a man-woman thing. It's a gender thing. We don't like women doing certain. Not for me. I mean, like I said, like you just said, Cersei, amazing, amazing villain in that way. And it's not for me. I'm using the word villain, but that's not even appropriate. It's like, from her point of view, she's doing the right thing. She has just as much right to act the way she's acting, just like Katie does. You know, from her point of view, resisting is the right way to go. It's how Katie's resisting, and it's how they're showing her make her decisions. Those don't tend to yield nearly what she thinks it's going to. And there's never that layer of complexity that you think like, oh my God, that was just so clever. I just, wow, that was just great. And I feel like if you're going to play the flip side of Will's coin, where he does have, you know, this background in investigation, he's got these physical skills, he has all these things going for him on his side, and like an authentic goal of trying to find his son, ultimately, I mean, that's really it. On her side, it just feels like maybe because there can't be a clear-cut goal for her that feels attainable.
Right.
There's nothing about Katie's mission of resisting. Resisting doesn't really mean overthrowing.
This whole time we've thought,
kind of rough, I guess. Maybe that's part of the problem I have with her. There's not a clear goal. And so, because they really don't have the goal of like evaporating the host. It's like resisting. That's the goal.
Yeah, we can assume this is a worldwide problem. So right. The idea of an unconnected network of resistors hijacking food trucks and then the aliens going, you know what, we're done, is just like, no way, Jose.
Okay, so there has to be something that I want to make sure that we're not missing. I mean, there is something to the concept of resistance that is powerful unto itself, but we have to find some way to give Katie some amount of credit, or the resistance in general, some amount of credit for like, what is that? What is the power of resistance? What is the nobility in not going against your morals? Even though at the end of the day, you cannot win. I suppose, honestly, some people could find that it is more noble, I guess, to stand your ground no matter the face of obvious defeat.
So Katie thinks that she's the Alamo.
Maybe. I mean, and okay, so for those of you, because I know we have worldwide listeners, kind of explain why here in Texas, the concept of resisting and standing your ground, even though there's so few of you, why does it matter? What was the point?
The point really was, like I think you just said, to resist, more or less. They Texans thought that the Alamo was theirs and the Mexican army didn't want to give it to them. But they were already in the Alamo, so they defended it, even though more and more army surrounded the Alamo.
And I mean, when we're talking like there was like handfuls of guys, you know, in the Texans trying to actually defend the Alamo, and there was so many more Mexican soldiers coming to
invade. It was hopeless.
It was absolutely hopeless. But, you know, they never gave it up. And that was a thing. And so definitely here in Texas, I mean, we consider
Davy Crockett, William Travis, Jim Bowie,
that they were all good, heroic men. And in reality, it's like they really, quote, were in the resistance, right? And they had no chance of winning. But they managed to kill so many more. They managed to, you know, really make a point, overall idea, right? That
yeah.
If you think you're going to come take Texas easily, think again. You know, every single one of us is going to fight to our dying breath to keep you out of here. And ultimately, we're not Mexico.
Right.
So, you know, so ultimately,
they did not win the battle of the Alamo. But 2 weeks later, Sam Houston settled Santa Ana's hash for the rest of time.
I guess I'm very much trying hard, very hard, to give Katie and the way that she's handling things some amount of fair shake in this. And I want to say, okay, if you are somebody who thinks that you're a resistor and that is the role that you play in trying to just say, I am an American, I am here, and I'm not going to change my value system. I'm not going to give up over to you, even to my dying breath, even though I know I'm going to die. Like I'm looking at death in the face, you know, then okay, I can definitely can give that some real respect. Again, though, please, I just wish that she was being written in a way that made it seem more sophisticated in the way that she went through that process.
This scene,
it's too basic
for
me.
Nolan and the way that she is treating Maddie in this whole Bram situation is part of why I don't like Katie.
Okay, so talk about what about the way that she... Well, let's talk about Maddie and everything that happened with Katie first, that conversation. So that conversation, I actually thought it was kind of cool how this interaction started, because it started with the point of view of the drone surveillance video kind of flying. And they did that a ton more in this episode.
Yeah.
There was a lot more of like looking through lenses and then you go through the scene. So I felt that vibe of like, we're watching you so much more this time.
Maddie, who mind you has only been Nolan's, what's the right word? Concubine for 2 weeks. She has managed to convince Nolan to act and try to keep Bram from going to the factory. And Katie isn't quite sure that she's done everything she could be doing with Nolan. This is 2 weeks, you know?
And remember that Maddie had safely gotten Gracie out of a horrible situation and now has a safe place in the green zone where she can get her tutoring for good or for bad. And she had the space set up for Bram too. If Bram hadn't bolted like he did, all the children would be in a great place. And in the whole, like, what about the children, you know, call of Katie, Maddie is doing it. You know, Maddie's keeping them safe. If you were Maddie, you would be so frustrated with Katie's just kind of spinning out kind of behavior.
Oh, for sure.
And it just seems like as much as Maddie keeps trying to say, I am taking care of it, you can trust me. It's like Katie never knows who to trust. She puts her trust in the wrong people or something. I'm not sure. There's something weird about it.
She's treating her sister like shit. I mean, she's basically saying, have you whored yourself out like completely?
Because like
I really need you to that level for this.
I don't know if I could have held back and not say, Katie, I already did everything for Bram. He was standing right next to me to walk through the pearly gates to the GZ and he ran. So like the fact that you're coming back essentially for a second time and saying, save my kid again. Oh my God.
Right.
Oh my God. And you're asking me to give up so much more when I was playing by the rules and I got him to safety and he bolted. And now you're asking me to get him to safety. But this time, he's got like this rap sheet that I've got to somehow get rid of.
And I've only had this boyfriend 2 weeks.
Like, and I know you're saying it like that, but I'm giving Maddie more credit because I feel like you're being dismissive of her, maybe because she is using her body.
Oh, I don't think dismissive. No, I wouldn't say that. I'm just saying that 2 weeks history is not enough to go on to bet the farm.
You're calling her a concubine and you're making her sound like because she's using her body.
Well, up until 2 weeks ago, Nolan was married.
Because she's using her body and because she's using sex and affection, that she isn't playing it smart in terms of the way she's manipulating Nolan, and that she's not just his side piece of ass. I mean, that's not what she is. She's setting herself up to be first lady next to him. She stands right beside him and discusses the plans for the day, how he should respond to various very high up leaders. She's not just in the bedroom. She's absolutely in the boardroom with him, discussing and planning and plotting together. That's a whole different relationship. And that's what I think we could have seen with Katie and Will. If Katie had played it differently, we could have seen, and we saw both sisters do this, both sisters used sex, use their bodies as ways to manipulate their men. But Maddie follows him out of bed and continues the conversation to talk about making the plan and making it a complex, real partnership plan.
That's some next level shit.
Where Katie would just run out the doggy door and go play with her pals, you know, and never kind of came around to say like, hey, maybe we could have worked this out together. See what I mean?
Yeah.
The sisters actually have very, very, very similar moves, but Katie was doing it so that Will would ignore her behavior, be like distracted by sex. Maddie's not trying to distract him with sex. Not at this point. She's trying to solidify their partnership.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
And it works, man. You can see his face, right? Like half the time, whenever she even starts kissing on his neck, he's like, I'm all yours, Maddie. Just keep wearing these zip-up, tie-up dresses and you're all good.
Well, I was on Maddie's side when she went and cleaned Katie's emotional clock.
So let's talk about that.
Although I did think it was a little shitty when she said, I'm just going to send Gracie back down to you. Like, wow, that's quite a bit. Actually, you know, it probably stands better that Gracie's not with Lindsay every day, but still, in terms of like physical safety, the green zone's going to be safer than where she's at.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. So what prompted that entire argument between Maddie and Katie?
Katie approaching Nolan like an ambush to re-ask, can you help with Bram, when the man has already done all he's going to do?
And I think that much of that was the setting. I mean, she did it out in public in front of a lot of other men. She did it in a way where Nolan had to be wearing his public persona face. Mm-hmm. Asking for favors in that type of situation, I thought his response of being like, I will pray for the reunification of your family, that is like, I can't believe that you were so ignorant to how our system works that you think the way to talk to me is to come to me out in public where there's obviously I have guards and such with me where I need to maintain a very specific profile. I can't look like I'm giving favors. Like, are you joking me? So it's once again, I just feel like maybe Katie could have figured out some other time to talk to Nolan. And I understand people would say, like blow up at me and say, well, when the hell is she supposed to talk to him?
Never.
I don't know exactly, because part of the point of trying to have favors and doing things quietly is like you can't be seen with him. You can't be seen talking with him about the situation. And we all know that those other men all around, they all have reason to turn him in for anything at any time. It's all rewarded.
Remember, this is modeled after the Nazis, which we know you could turn in your neighbor for different things.
And you're encouraged to, that's actually the way you handle things, is that if something was being talked about, you need to go and turn them in. So again, I feel like Katie very short-sightedly put Nolan in a very dangerous scenario, because if he did anything, if he was taken off guard enough to actually kind of begin that conversation with her and be like, oh, Katie, I'm so sorry, but and right. like showed any empathy, he would absolutely damage himself, which where would that land Maddie, Hudson, Gracie? All of it would blow up for them too. So it pisses me off that Katie would be desperate, that she does things that constantly break down the chain that other people are trying to make so that it could be strong enough to pull Charlie out or pull Bram out. She just keeps going around and nicking at this stuff in ways that it's like, friend, that is not the way to have any of us viewers appreciate her in any form or fashion. I cannot appreciate how ignorant she's being to how the system works. It even seems as resistors that they would have given her more information. This is the way we approach things. If you just approach someone out in public, you're basically exposing your own self. Mm-hmm. And that's foolish. That isn't a long-term gain. So I don't know. This was like felt horrible in this moment. And of course, I felt terrible for Katie for thinking that this was the way to go. Can we come up with any other scenario that Katie could have handled this where she felt like if she needed to talk directly to Nolan, or should she just have simply had the understanding that it took a while for Maddie to bend Nolan's ear? Katie doesn't have the status to have any type of audience
if at
with
all,
Nolan.
It should have been in private, like through Maddie.
So do you think, do you think that like this was a no-win situation in terms of ever speaking to Nolan?
I'm proposing a meeting at Nolan's house with Nolan fully knowing that you're coming would have been the only possible way that you could make this ask after Maddie had already made her attempt.
That would have gone poorly
for Nolan
as well.
To receive it. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right. I honestly think that would have been a step closer to better, but I honestly think there is no way, because she's not taking into account this like insulation factor of each of the positions. The idea that Maddie actually got close enough to be within the inner circle, she then needs to just speak to just Maddie. I think he has actual true feelings for her. I want to think beyond physical, because their argument, you know, about Bram is basically him saying, you know, I care so much about you and Hudson that if I turn in this favor and try to help Bram any more than I already have, then I'm not going to have any favors left to cash in for you. So for me, I want to say that the rest of that sentence isn't, and then who will I have sex with? I want to think that the rest of it is because I actually care about you, Maddie. And so in that case, I feel like I don't understand why Katie thinks, you know, she should be, I don't know. I just don't get it. I really appreciate what you were bringing up about Gracie and about what role that she's starting to play in this whole mess, because the message about sending Gracie back to me wasn't about, well, here, forget it. It was more like, if you're going to question the way that I'm keeping your children safe, then maybe it's best I just give her back to you.
Mm.
And if you think that you have it all figured out and you can do a better job than I can, and you seem to know better than how I'm handling things, then hey, in all love, here's your child back. I do not want to be responsible if you think I'm handling it wrong. So I didn't take that quite as nasty as you're kind of saying it.
Yeah, I took it more like,
I'm going to take my ball and go home.
No, it's more like, you are a liability to me and what I'm trying to build. I'm going to disconnect from you now.
100% that is, of course, something that would be a part of it. But if you tried to find the nicest way to think about it, and it would be difficult, you would think, you know, hey, Katie, if you've got the roadmap to all of us not being under the thumb of aliens, then by all means, take your children and head there, you know, because I'm trying to work the same thing, but I don't see the way you're handling things as the way to do it. Now, when Gracie comes back and Katie's all crying about Bram, Gracie has this really strange moment where she's blaming herself. I think that we're going to start to see some other really, really freaky brainwashing stuff where, you know, the idea of a children turning their parents in some way, or giving up some information, is really frightening. She may very well be in a position to say something. I'm thinking it's going to be about Katie, because I don't know who else it would be about right at this minute. She doesn't really have access to anyone else, but does that feel right?
That could happen. I think it's more in keeping with the amount of story that they've given Gracie so far, that it would be more like, just we get an idea of what's been going on up at Nolan's house, and maybe her relationship with Maddie has just disintegrated, but maybe she finds out more about this religion, knows that Maddie's involved, and is freaked out for Maddie, you know, and wants to go and try to prevent her from getting too involved with this new religion.
So let's talk about that. Maddie had a big week in her religious level ups, right? Like, she had a big, huge moment. So they have this thing, it was called an initiation, right?
That's probably right.
And basically, like, induction. Was it induction? Oh, what was it? It was basically like that, the idea that she was going to be brought into their inner circle here, their true inner circle. And they had, you know, a whole portion where she's going to make promises. Then they had this freaky moment with that box. What in the world was in that box? What is that?
I can't answer that, except that we know what she saw, which was very heavenly seeming, but she only got to experience it for a second, or maybe it was a very long time, but to her it only felt like a second. It's sort of like a Vaseline on the lens sort of sensation.
I felt very like euphoric. Yeah. There was like sort of this like floating kind of feel about it, which again, that a little made me think back to that underwater womb sound, you know, that ultrasound. It kind of sounded like she was like floating around, you know, like that might be the audio you would hear, you know, with that same kind of whooshing and floating in water kind of feeling.
If you could go into any church and touch a box and see that, I think that church would have record signups. And that I'm not sure if Maddie is involved with this religion as a way to become closer to Nolan and kind of advance within that culture, or if now she's a believer. But that box would go a long way to making you believe in something bigger.
Doesn't it a little bit also kind of a little feel like drinking the Kool-Aid or something? Like, where you almost, it's like a drug effect?
I think so. Because you'd want more of that box. Yeah, if you felt that box, you'd want more of that box.
Yeah, so it feels a lot like getting high in some strange way where, like you said, it almost would be like addicted, you know, an addictive feeling. So that seems like that is going to
just
start.
Watching it, I was like, can we go find a box like that?
Oh my God, you're awesome. You're like, let's totally do some box tonight, honey. Yeah, exactly. And so I do think that moment is my fearful moment for Maddie, where all the plans and all the carefully laid moments that she had trying to get in the position she is with Nolan and think about where they're going to go next. I feel like that addictive nature of that box is going to suddenly overwhelm her. I think it's going to be like, yeah. I just think she's going to become like a pod person, right? I don't think we're going to be able to trust that Maddie's going to be able to not be thinking about that box.
Yeah, there's going to be some things. I bet there's some things where we see Maddie has made some tough decisions that don't go in the favor of the Bowman family.
And you know what? Can you even understand like where she might be coming from in terms of like, if you felt this feeling out of body, out of this world kind of sensation, would that put your earth life in some sort of perspective that might make you think that, well, this is lame and you guys trying to preserve our way of life is not anything of what you could feel or it could be like.
It would be major. I hope that whatever she does decide and has driven her to go through these things, she doesn't lose sight of, or at least the storytellers don't lose sight of the fact that she did all this because Hudson needs insulin and it's really hard to get.
You're right. The love of your kid is powerful. That has been shown over and over in the show. What would the love of your child, you know, lead you to do? So will that be enough to break her from the spell of this amazing box? I don't know. Nolan's eyes, when he hugged her after she put the box down, he was like, yes, my pretty, like you're under my spell now. Like, ooh, that felt like yickety and definitely made me feel like, oh man, I really wanted him to like love her. And this is getting a little spookier. Like we thought Maddie trapped Nolan. I think Nolan might've just trapped Maddie.
All right. So you ready to talk about Bram just a little bit?
Absolutely.
A lot of stuff happens to Bram, but he's only got a little bit of story. And I think he is there primarily to show us where Proxy Snyder wound up.
I think so, too. I think that his story this week was really a vehicle to show us where Proxy was. And I was super glad to see that Proxy was alive and okay. And he seemed legitimately
in a depressive state.
Yeah, for sure. Very downtrodden. So we did find out that Bram
was meant for the factory.
Yeah.
And was diverted.
I mean, Nolan was taking credit for that, right?
I think so. Yeah.
So we think that was good. And so he went to like a labor camp. It was interesting too about learning to know what to say. I gave credit to Bram for not just being like spitting in the guy's, making himself a little older, saying he's 20, saying he's a construction worker, showing specific skills. Like those are things that we haven't seen a lot of the resistance people doing, where it's like, know the right answers to say in these specific situations that I appreciated. I felt like it's like play by the rules to get further in it. Don't stomp his foot and run away. You know,
maybe that's why nonsense. Bram was always in the doghouse with his parents. Because remember the first episode of first season, there was some baggage that he, sort of like a kid who's just constantly grounded for one reason or mm-hmm. another. He seemed to have that baggage. I don't remember what it was exactly, but because they never really said.
Remember, like,
and they show him getting in a fight at school, and he breaks the rules of the radio and all that kind of stuff. So he has a string of infractions, you know, along the way here.
Yeah, dude, he's factory fodder for real.
Maybe he's just a compulsive liar, and that's why he could. Maybe that's why he's been in the doghouse so much, and maybe that's why he's so easily created a backstory for himself.
Intrigue. See, I didn't know. I don't know if compulsive liar has a pretty negative connotation there, Paul. That's a pretty harsh thing to call him. He's proven to be more adaptable, and he's proven to find ways to get information that allows him to kind of work within the system. So again, like sort of finding the radio and just listening in a way that doesn't endanger necessarily other people. Now, I know it would be obviously clear having a radio in the house could endanger the rest of your family, but it's not in the same blatant ways that I feel like we saw other resistors doing things, you know?
Okay.
He was a little more conservative and a little bit more, shoot, this might sound like really like splitting hairs, but I feel like that is the difference between a character I can kind of say, okay, I kind of understand where you're coming from and I appreciate the way you handled it versus I can't stand what you just did. It is splitting hairs. I mean, it's the way you word things, the comments you make, the not wearing a mask, Katie. It's those small moments that are creating my whole opinion of you. So the whole brand proxy interaction there, the eyes meeting, how did you feel Proxy's face? What was his body language? How do you think he felt when he saw Bram?
Well, he lingered. He didn't make a face. He didn't raise an eyebrow. He didn't widen his eyes. He didn't do anything, but he did let his gaze sit on Bram a second or two longer than you would if you didn't recognize him.
Was it simply recognition, or do you think something inside of his heart was thinking what? Like, oh no, that's Will Bowman's kid? Or like, what the hell? That's Will Bowman's kid? Or, oh God, I gotta help Will Bowman's kid? Or like, where do you think, what was his feel?
The way his face looked and the way it stayed just was like, well, nothing surprises me anymore. And then he went back to his office.
Okay, so I got a total different read. I actually felt like I saw his heart sink. The way that he was getting along in his world so far is that maybe he hadn't seen anyone he knew. But when he saw that it was Will's son, and he knew that Will's whole point and how important his children were, that he was going to go do all of this just to get to Santa Monica to get his other son, I felt like you could see his heart just go like, oh, to his stomach, like, fuck. I do feel like Proxy, in everything that we found out about him, I do feel like he, I hesitate to say help Bram, but I want to say that there's going to be something about the way he handles some situation that is going to at least create a crack in the system for Bram to be able to, I think Bram's still going to have to take initiative and have to be able to get himself out in some form or fashion. I don't know. Maybe just crack the door open enough for Will to come in and save Bram. Don't think Proxy himself has the leverage at this point to in any way get Bram out of the situation. But I do think that all the time spent between Will and Proxy, he's a compassionate enough person that this just feels like such a blow to the Bowman family than to have another kid gone.
Interesting. You already have a much greater innate ability to read a face than I do. And I hope you're right. Because to me, he just looked defeated, over.
I think defeated is not off from what I'm saying at all. It's that disappointment. It is visible. Like the defeated part is like, it got like personal in that moment, you know, where he's had conversations with the family. Peter Jacobson played it so subtle. The last two episodes, I really felt great about the way that he used his facial features and his body language. Because, you know, if we have any issue with the words that they're saying, I love it that the actors could bring something to it just in the way that they deliver it or not, or just the look of their face, you know, is enough to say like, there's more behind this. I appreciate that a ton. There was another girl in that cafeteria that had asked him to sit with her and stuff. I do think that obviously she's going to come into play. Maybe she's going to help be that stepping stone to get out. Maybe out together.
He needs to know how to get along in prison. And she already knows how to get along in prison.
So everybody's got to have a mentor, right? Yes. We talked about this a whole lot about, you know, Bo mentoring Will. Devin now taking over that role for Will to be the mentor out over in Santa Monica.
Because he needs a lesson as quickly as she can deliver it. And thankfully, she has television writers and they know how to deliver a message in a very short amount of time. So she gets him stitched up and nursed back to health and fully informed about how things work over here within the span of like a day.
Yeah, we got some information from someone who had written in, Michael. Shout out to you for letting us know that there had been an explanation that there was not enough red hats.
He wrote back and said that it was a preview that was up, that was put up where she explains it. So maybe it was on the website or something, but it was something published.
Way to snag the information and bring it forward. We appreciate that, Michael. That's awesome. Basically, if anybody didn't catch it, they didn't have enough red hats to cover Santa Monica. The warlords took over and basically they just kind of are leaving it to the citizens to fight it out amongst themselves. It sounds like leaving wild dogs out there to just be like, well, it's too much hassle to round them all up. Eventually, it's doggy dogs. They're going to kill each other. And so just you do let remember them do that.
At the end of last season, when we met Charlie, they were shaking down an old guy, right? The kids.
Oh, yeah.
But the Red Hats did show up on that scene.
It took a significantly longer, though. They were able to get away.
And I don't remember if they had a drone with them. And
I don't remember if they had a drone.
So far in this incarnation, this season's representation of Santa Monica, the Red Hats in Santa Monica have been absent.
The guy who seems to be running the town is this Solomon, who has this entire network. He's very Negan-esque in that he requires offerings of various people to head to the factory. And so I guess he must be also then working with the host people in some way.
Why do you say factory? I didn't get anything like he had any connection to the factory.
Because Devin says you never would have brought her in if you knew she was going to the factory when they brought the bounty girl in.
Oh, okay. Okay. Keep going.
Somehow Solomon has to pay dues to someone else to turn over people to go to the factory. I mean, like a quota system. Or
it could be, and this is just supposition because they didn't show this, but it could be that the woman that they go and get, maybe there's a bounty on her. And people like Solomon turn in heads, have bounties on them, and that's part of their income.
But I also think that in return, you know, how bounty hunters are a little left alone. It's for Solomon's own safety. He gets left alone and able to like run his show over there because he's turning over people on a regular basis.
Right.
But then that just makes him in part of the hierarchy, you know, and he sort guess of. What? Then everyone's still working for the host, you know?
Well,
you're just further down the chain.
Like bounty hunters are quasi court officials, you know? They do carry a little badge and all that, but it's really just more like to intimidate you than to actually say that they're representing a specific governmental body.
I think he's got his own Negan is my point. They have shown us time and time again that every level has a level above, and whenever something goes bananas, the level above comes down hard on levels below, a la Dan Bennett, right?
Yeah.
So clearly now with this whole Solomon sitch, about to get the wrath of Solomon's boss down on Will. When Devin brings Will to Solomon's group, she's like, oh, you know, we're getting this girl, whatever. And the guy says, you know, I've always pictured you as a lone wolf. Like, you have a partner now. Devin's face looks guilty because she says some comment like, oh, I'm just trying him out. But there's something about her face that's like, I'm still a lone wolf. Like, there's nothing about this situation where I'm not looking out for Devin.
Oh, I think she's going to sell him out at some point.
I think she has to. And you know what? I feel like her last words are going to be like, you had no problem selling me out. You had no problem saying that dirty agent or anything. And so guess what? Prophecy was correct. Now I am officially a dirty agent. Maybe she never did anything wrong in the past, but this was one of those things I feel like she carried on her heart. Plus, I also think that everything that we saw about this episode is that the amount of psychological warfare that has gone on with all of our characters is becoming more and more intense. The behavior of everyone is dictated by survival in a way that turning in other people and shielding yourself in any way possible, it's just a part of life. She's not even being a bad person in any form or fashion. It's the only way to survive.
Mm-hmm.
What did you think about sending him up there with no weapon or anything? Did you feel like, was she trying to kind of feed him to the wolves? Or was it just like, she just knew he'd be good enough to be able to punch his way out?
I think she knew what to expect. She wasn't selling him out at this point. She needed him to trust her starting now. And it proves that she does know the score around her neighborhood. She does know how things work. So it did go a long way to just proving she is an asset to Will on this misadventure in Santa Monica.
Okay, let's get down to the meat of this, which is we finally have our Charlie Will reunion.
With the Uncle Solomon looking over Will's shoulder. Very creepy scene.
Oh my God. So when Charlie finally runs over and gives Will a hug and they kind of run to each other, and then like over the fence is like Solomon's like freako eyes. Was this just basically like anytime you show any type of connection to another person, all you're basically doing is painting a giant bullseye on your back because now you've got like a weakness. Everybody knows you're going to be jacked around with.
Over the past year, Solomon has made it seem like he's been protecting Charlie from Charlie's point of view, even though he's just using Charlie. Yes, he's a crafty kid that's a good earner. Isn't that what mm-hmm, he called him?
Yeah. Producer. He's producer, a high producer.
Doesn't really translate to affection or anything like that.
Oh, no, not at all. I don't think that's what this world is about at all.
No.
Charlie, it turns out, has some major Stockholm syndrome here.
Yes.
Even though he goes back with Will to Devin's house, I mean, he clearly a mess. I appreciated that they didn't go into major detail because I don't really like the super gory stuff, but it was very clear when he was like, I had to learn and that kind of stuff. Oh man, that's the user catchphrase.
What Will needed to go from the guy that went to the bonfire with his hands up showing a picture of his son to a guy that went back to where the bonfire was with a completely different attitude.
So what did you think? I knew you loved it. I'm pretty sure you yelled boom in the living room as it started happening.
Oh, yeah. That guy that stabbed him and smarted off to him and getting a shotgun right to the belly like that. Man, that was awesome. Will's a former Army Ranger with FBI training.
Yep.
And Josh Holloway does a really, I don't know, I'm not a cop, but he looked pretty credible in terms of cleaning and clearing that place out. I mean, it was just, his shots were like bang. And,
yeah,
and he would just turn his body, cover another corner, do it, and just keep going around. And he seemed to suspect where the bad guys would be coming from. I know, obviously, it's written that way, but still, it was very just efficient. He was never really in any danger.
He wasn't.
Because he was so much better at this than these guys that had just picked up guns and, you know, learned how to be thugs because it was just their chance and no one else was around. And he's trained and has done this for years.
Yes.
Now, killing Solomon might be like, you know, a hornet's nest of problems later, but in terms of like father and son business, you don't have two daddies anymore, do you?
Oh my God. Oh my goodness. Do you think that that will have been enough that Charlie will trust, will protect him?
Eventually. I don't know that it's right away going to be like, oh, that was, you know, something Charlie, because Charlie's kind of little still. So
yeah, I appreciated that the other children didn't run to Will, even though from our point of view, we're like, no, he's a safe guy, go to him. But they kept that realistic. I think anytime you see someone come in and blow everyone away, you should just run, even if they claim to be the saviors. You know, you still go hide. That was very realistic.
That's good survival instinct anyway.
Yeah, that's, I mean, if you're little bitties, you've got to have like level 10, you know, survival instinct to have made it this far. There's adult grown ass men who aren't getting blown away.
Right.
Overall, how did you feel about this episode?
Oh, great. The season one MacGuffin has been recovered, and we got to see a pretty cool action sequence with our hero coming out on top. I enjoyed the episode quite a bit on that level. Lots of frustration still with Katie, but at least we get to see also that Proxy Snyder, the fight has gone out of him quite a bit since we last saw him, but at least he's still alive. I think that this show, in a lot of ways, is going to be about Proxy Snyder as well as the Bowmans.
I think it was very clever of them to start pairing people up, sort of the ones that we didn't care about with the ones that we thought were more competent. If they take Bram, who we kind of thought was just kind of like you said, being kind of rambunctious, getting into trouble, whatever, he seemed like a real liability. And you put him with Proxy, who we thought was making some very clever moves in order to stay where he was, that somehow feels more solid. Feel the same way about linking Jennifer and Katie. Jennifer hasn't turned me off yet. She's still being written competently. Pairing her with a character who has, you know, weak and flawed feels again like, okay, you're making a partnership that feels like we can get some yin and yang. Maybe they can balance each other out a little bit. Maybe we can get some more clever moves as a twosome.
Mm-hmm.
Concept of delving in the idea of the psychological warfare. You can't unsee things or undo in your own mind and in your own heart things that you had to do to survive, and the guilt that Charlie would feel about that, the really mixed up notions of what you have to do to be submissive to someone else, the whole abuse part. They made it very relatable. Someone who's been dominated, how that person would behave.
Especially for a kid.
Yeah, but I don't think it even has to be a kid. I think it could be any situation. Anybody who has been dominated for so long and then they finally get free and they don't want to go. There's a confusion there of like, what's the matter with you? Why don't you just run away? And they kind of forget about the psychological part. It wasn't all just about the physical chains. There were all these mental games that were played with them. Will be interesting to bring Will and Charlie back over to the LA block. A reunion isn't gonna be a reunion. You know,
yeah, it's going to be rough.
Nobody's minds and souls are anywhere near to who they used to be. So even if they're like in proximity with each other, you've got Gracie who's all brainwashed. You've got Katie who's just flailing out there. You've got Will who has done and seen things. Charlie who has done and seen things. Even if you physically all get back together under the same roof, this is not the family that you thought you were reuniting. And that is complicated. And I think
you're still one son down. But it may be like the Starks in Game of Thrones. They separate in the first season and they have to wait until the sixth season to even see one another again. That's a lot of work.
It is. And a lot of water under the bridge. A lot of things have happened to those individual characters where they did a good job of showing Charlie so whimsical and so, like you said, the life of the family.
Right. Keeping up with baseball transactions is a not frivolous exactly, but it does show, like we just said, like more of a carefree, like I have time to care about baseball transactions.
And he had a lot of spirit to him and a lot of, you know, he seemed like a happy kid. And so to have seen that last episode and to see him now with the fear and the almost animalistic, like, I just have to use my instincts only. I mean, that was harder to see that moment than it was to initially realize Charlie was on the other side of the wall. Because there was some part that you wanted to think that Charlie was physically safe. And that's kind of all we thought about. Like, you had to physically get him back. Mm-hmm. But now that we see that it is not going to be that easy, the mental side is going to be a challenge that we hope they can win.
And we're going to need Mom on board for this.
Can you imagine? Oh my God. You know, I have to throw out one more thing about Katie this week that it gets under my skin. And I really hope that they find a way to address this. Somehow, every single person around her has managed to be the one at blame, including the children. Like, remember how you said last week, you said, you know, this is all messed up. Why is Will the one who is always bearing the brunt that he was responsible for Charlie not being picked up?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a really like mirroring situation when Gracie was crying and saying that she was responsible for Bram being gone. There's something about the way that the people in her family interact with Katie that somehow creates this sense that they are the one that needs to bear all the responsibility for everything. And even though she's like the mom and an adult and all this kind of stuff, there's a strange, like, I don't know, like, I don't know if it's protectiveness of Katie, but like everyone is willing to take the responsibility of things that actually, when you go back to it, you're like, but Katie had a big role in that and could have done something. And I've very rarely seen Katie actually say, no, I'm responsible for how this happened.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know she told Gracie, no, you know, honey, it's not. And I get it. She was like comforting her. But I think it was even a major leap for Gracie to think she was responsible for Bram. And then we had just said how irritating it was for Will to be taking the responsibility. So what is that about her character? And what is this dynamic? Are they all just being loving and protecting and thinking that you just don't blame Mom? I do hope that they address it at some point. And somehow she very clearly says, I made this decision that caused X, Y, Z. And it's not because I want her to feel guilty and awful, but I want the other characters to have an opportunity to release themselves of all this insane guilt. Maybe it will inform her decisions moving forward, and it could be more healthy if she would stop and think, wait, when I did that, it caused that. And now I need to take responsibility for that. I would love to see some growth there for her character. You know, do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. She's living very moment to moment. And really, just as a mom, it's impossible to actually live that way. You just end up saying little platitudes to your kids like, no, it's not your fault, but not really even knowing why they're feeling that way.
Well, and I feel like there's a lot of times when you can say something like, it's not your fault, honey. That is a very different statement to me than saying, you are a kiddo and these things that are happening are adult issues. And they're happening because adults are making decisions. And you need to never think that you are in a position that you need to be taking on that level of responsibility. Now, do you need to say it in a lot more kid-friendly way to Gracie? Absolutely. But there are times when, you know, our kids have thought one thing or another, and rather than even discussing with them whether or not that situation is true or not true, it's more like that is something that adults have the responsibility to fix, not you. You don't even have to worry about that because you are a little guy and this isn't a little guy issue. This is so much bigger than that. Adults have to figure it out. And I feel annoyed at her for not even just taking that onus off of Gracie, but then just everybody else too. You know, like there's some things that aren't about everybody else, right?
Right.
So what do you hope that happens coming for the rest of the season? Now, if do you think Charlie and them are coming back over the wall next week? Or do we have some weeks to go? Does he have to fight it out more in Santa Monica? Or we got to get back to the block?
When he goes back to Devon's and say, well, I killed everybody, that may have some fallout.
So do we experience the fallout in Santa Monica? Or do you think it's just like toot sweet back over to LA block?
If I was Will, I'd go find my Cadillac, get my kid inside and go back home and just take whatever the punishment was that's coming, I guess, or sneak. I'd probably sneak, actually.
Sneak.
Yes, I think I would sneak.
Well, because how do you get Charlie across? Do children have to have transit passes, or is it like, he's with me?
That's a fine question. I mean, they just waved him through.
They did.
But that was from LA to Santa Monica, you know.
And he looks a bunch more grungy coming back. He doesn't look like a clean agent like he did going through.
Maybe coming from Santa Monica to LA is a different thing. Remember when they at the first episode when they wanted to take the truck that Will was supposed to hide inside?
Yeah.
They had a whole thing where they even traded out drivers because they didn't want the LA driver.
Like contamination.
Right. So they might have a thorough process for transferring.
So make a guesstimate. We're only in episode 2. We have to us episode 10. When do Charlie and Will make it back into the LA block? Episode what?
I'll say 5.
Okay. So you think we've got 2 solid episodes of,
because I think he might have broken things for Devon, and Devon might be like, you can't go anywhere and leave me with this mess. That's just my guess.
Okay. I like that. I think that one whole episode of dealing with some fallout in Santa Monica makes good sense to me. Do you think Devon comes with to LA block, or is just like no way to get, or has she served her purpose in the story?
I mean, I don't recognize the actress, but she's a really good actress and a good character. So I don't see them writing, you know, giving her a backstory and a history with Will. I don't see that being just like a, well, ta-ta kind of.
Yeah, but you know what I always feel about that? You know, we talk about reality shows when that week they give you the whole backstory of that person and I go, shit, they're the ones getting voted off, because you guys know they can't hang on to their backstory to episode 10 if she is going to get voted off in number 3. So they blow her backstory right at the beginning. Now I'm like, ooh, I kind of, you know, I wonder if Devon is going to take the fall for them to be able to get through. Somehow create a distraction, a diversion, something to, and it's not like she owes it to him. In fact, vice versa. Like he's the one who's calling her dirty and then he comes over to her and she helps, you know? And so she doesn't owe him at this point in any way, but do you think they will use her as a character who will be the one to figure out how to get him through and maybe end up dying or getting caught because of it?
Man, the first thing that came to mind was maybe she'll knock him out and steal the transit pass and try to use it herself.
Piss, I know, because, you know, why not? Why wouldn't you? I don't know how in the hell she deals with life in LA. Man, I don't know how she bebops through and then like, I don't know what happens on the other side. It's not like you don't have to have a position in the LA block to make sense of why you're here, you know?
Sure.
So,
but at least you don't have to answer your door with a shotgun either.
Amen, my lord. I totally agree to that. And there's oranges in the backyard.
So it's a little better.
Forget about the oranges. Although food rationing was looking crummier and crummier. Katie didn't get her box of food, and they were saying they were running out of food. The next episodes are going to show more and more desperation within the LA block, maybe mirroring some of the stuff we saw in Santa Monica.
Yeah, they should have walled off Nebraska and, you know, made a farm colony.
You know, we got to figure out where Proxy's daughter is. They had a garden.
Yeah. Okay.
The commune.
Right.
The commune. And I assume, is that in the LA block, you think?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So it's actually like some sort of a smaller wall within a wall, if you will, a garden wall.
Right.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. And if you guys have any feedback, we love it. I love talking to Ken and Michael and everybody who's got a comment to talk to us about. We did get some feedback on the guns from a California listener who did fill us in and say, you know, there's a lot of ex-military, there's a lot of bases out there, and, you know, plenty of our California brethren have firearms.
Thanks a lot. Catch us on iTunes or your preferred podcast software. Our website, dailyreview.com, that's D-A-L-E-Y review.com, Facebook or Twitter, or wherever you find us, please leave us a comment and a rating to let us know what you think of the show.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.